Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And our guest today is our friend Russell Moore, who joined us in an early podcast in his role as Chief Experience Officer of the USS Hornet Sea Air and Space Museum in Alameda, California, one of my favorite museums ever. Yeah. And I wanted to have him back today to tap his expertise in a completely different subject that we'll explain in a minute. So welcome back to the podcast, Russ.
Thanks for having me, you guys.
Al, what do we got?
All right. We're doing in here in minute 73. In the overcast Italian camp, Steve Rogers and Peggy Carter stand amidst the cheering men of the 107, their eyes locking briefly as the crowd's energy swirls around them. The camera pulls upward, capturing the sea of triumphant soldiers. The scene shifts to Washington, where Senator Brandt strides to a podium outside the Capitol building, flanked by Marines in crisp dress uniforms. "I'm honored to present this medal for valor to my personal friend, Captain America," Brandt declares, raising a hand toward the doorway behind him. "Captain America. Captain, that's your cue." Brandt's assistant apologetically steps through the doorway and quietly says something in Brandt's ear. In the audience, a general bearing a striking resemblance to comic book creator Stan Lee leans toward a colleague and whispers, "I thought he'd be taller." At the bustling Strategic Scientific Reserve headquarters, deep beneath London's streets, Steve stands before a large tactical map, pointing decisively. The fifth one was here in Poland, right near the Baltic. The sixth one was about here, 30, 40 miles west of the Maginot Line. I just got a quick look, says Steve. Peggy, standing beside him, flashes a smile. "Well, nobody's perfect." Steve continues, "These are the weapon factories we know about. Sergeant Barnes said that Hydra shipped all the parts," and that's where the minute ends.
That's our minute. Well, let's give a passing salute to Stan Lee and Hal's fine impression of Stan Lee.
Yes.
That was an excellent Stan Lee.
Well, one does one's humble best to please, Brian.
New York all the way, yeah.
Good to meet him. Met him a couple of times when he was here, and we technically sort of kind of worked together to create a comic book character, but that's a story for another day.
Oh, let's do that next episode.
It's very, very that, technically.
But I want to introduce Russell Moore. First, I want to give him full credit for the work he's done. Russell's work aboard the Hornet has led to him writing two books, one titled USS Hornet CV-12, Service in War and Peace, as well as a children's book titled Hornet CV-12, USS Hornet Museum Explorer's Book, and they're both excellent. He's written magazine articles on a wide assortment of World War II topics, but what inspired me to ask him back for this particular minute of the movie is Colonel Phillips and his staff looming over that giant tabletop map of World War II battlefields festooned with little models of any enemy bases, which is something Russ does in real life, not as a soldier, but as a game player. For the past few years, he's hosted national two-day war game tournaments aboard the Hornet, a pastime I know very little about, but it's a passion of his. And so Russ, welcome, and please introduce us to the world of Flames of War. What do you do, and what is it?
Well, thanks again for having me, you guys. Yeah, Flames of War is a lot of fun. So it combines several different things. You get to play a strategic war game on the tabletop, but even before you get to do that, you have to buy, build, and paint your models. So if you're one of those people that grew up building models when you were a kid, this hobby sort of combines that with wargaming. And you're doing it on the tabletop with real things that you're pushing around. So they're small tanks and artillery guns and things like that, but you really feel like you're kind of immersed a little bit more than just playing a flat board game or maybe just playing a video game that you would watch online. And so what I loved about that segment in the movie when they're looking at the big map is that we do that a lot of times where you have a big strategic map of a large battle that's going on. And as you're pushing pieces around, when the pieces bump into each other, you say, okay, now that turns into a battle that you play out on the tabletop. And so then you'll have two players facing each other with their armies of little models that they've built and painted. And then they play for a couple of hours to see who wins the battle.
So is the purpose of the game to recreate famous battles, like, you know, do the Battle of the Bulge 2 out of 3 and see who wins? Or is it all new battles and all new terrain? I know you focus on World War II, but how does the game work?
So the answer to all your questions is actually yes. So you can do both. So sometimes when we're playing Flames of War tournament, we are recreating something like exactly the Battle of Bulge or Operation Market Garden, you know, so famous battles. And then it's your chance to, what would you have done if you were on the battlefield? Could you change history a little bit? And a lot of other times it's just hypothetical battles where armies that maybe never faced each other get a chance to face each other, or you get to try something a little bit different that you like. And I mostly played the World War II version of it, but actually this game runs from World War I all the way up to sort of what they call, what is the new one called? They do basically World War III, essentially with, you know, so what if, right? So wars that could have happened anywhere from the 60s to today. So people also play with these modern armies. And in those cases, it's literally mostly hypothetical because obviously we didn't have a war.
Yeah. My sense is in fighting these battles, building the models, painting them, you really get to know the real life terrain. You get to know the soldiers and their equipment very well. Does the game make you an expert on Sherman tanks, or are you drawn to the game because you're already an expert in Sherman tanks?
I would say it's a little bit of both. Some people that play the game are already deeply, you know, sort of embedded in military history, like me. But I have also learned so much more from playing the game, because you're exactly right. Once you start to build and paint the models, you look at it, you're like, wow, I didn't know that they attach shovels to the back of the tank here and stuff like that. Like all these little details that come to life as you're building the models. Plus, as you're reading the books and you're building your armies, you're learning the statistics. Like, why was this gun, you know, better than that gun? Why did this tank have armor that didn't seem to stop shells very well? And why did this one work much better? And so as you're playing the game and building your forces, you're also learning the history and the technology behind it. So, yeah, it's both, again.
So, Russ, I'm assuming this is a turn-based game. Is that right?
More or less. So you take your turn and you move your armies, shoot them, and then your opponent takes their turn. There are some things that you do during your opponent's turn, but mostly it is my turn, then your turn, then my turn back.
Right.
And for each dice involved?
Yes. So, and that's why I personally love the game, because I think that, you know, despite having the best strategy and the best army, you can still lose because things just go wrong sometimes. And so your dice just go cold, or you can pull off an amazing upset when your dice get really hot, just like what happened in the real war. Sometimes a force that had no business winning will pull off a victory, or vice versa, right?
Yeah, just a little bit of luck in their favor.
Is it generally one-on-one, or can you have more than two players, you know, as opponents?
So that's the other fun of the game, because, again, it's almost anything that you want. The typical way you play is one-on-one, especially when you're playing a tournament. You're trying to go through multiple rounds, 3, 4, 5, 6 battles to see who comes out on top as the best general for the day. But we also do what we call, you know, mega battles, where you get a giant table and you put 3 or 4 players on a side, and you've got, you know, massive armies moving back and forth across the table, duking it out, which is also a lot of fun. I did one game once where we had 2 tables next to each other, and we put the Nijmegen Bridge between the tables. And so we were doing Operation Market Garden. We were fighting for the bridge from both sides, just like in the war.
Wow.
That's fantastic. Russell, you mentioned things like statistics. And so I used to, when I was a kid, I had a dear friend named Clint. We lost him to cancer a few years ago. But he and I, for whatever reason, we got really into this Avalon Hill big tabletop board/strategy games. You know, we weren't building models and things like that. It doesn't strike me that was as much of a thing back in, say, the early 80s. But we'd play these big long campaigns, and somehow for he and I, we just gelled with it. Like I could go to his place for a weekend and we could play a 16-hour, you know, European air war campaign and just love it. But, you know, for a game like that, is it similar with Flames of War, where you've got a tank, and this tank can move X number of spaces depending on the terrain. If it's got its gun, if the gun has got this much range, it's got this much damage it does. Is it sort of along those lines?
Yep. I used to play a lot of Squad Leader, Panzer Leader, a lot of Avalon Hill games when I was younger. Still have a lot of them in my closet, just harder to find opponents now. Just imagine taking that flat board game and just making it 3D, and that's really the only difference. So what used to be a flat counter with a tank on it that has its stats on it, you now have those stats sort of on the side on a card, and then you've got the 3D tank on the board. So yeah, my tank moves 12 inches. It can fire 40 inches. This is the strength of its gun. This is the strength of your armor. So let's roll and see what happens. Very similar. If you played Avalon Hill games back in the day and you had the patience to build models, you would probably love Flamethrower.
That's fantastic. Well, you're making me nostalgic for those days, that's for sure.
So do you, I know you have the tournaments, but do you play with the same person or group of people? Do you have a little local
squadron
folks who get together? Squadron, yeah.
Yeah. So here in California, we've got a gaming club called NorCal Flames of War, and that kind of encompasses people from pretty much San Jose up to Sacramento. I'd say there's a good maybe 30 or 40 of us that semi-regularly play. We have a sort of an every other week gaming event, and most people can't make that many times, but let's say you manage to get in about a once a month game. But there are gaming clubs all over America and all over the world. So I actually am on Team Ireland in the European Championships. So in August, I have to fly to Milan, Italy to participate in this European Team Championship as a member of Team Ireland. Since both of my grandparents, both of my grandfathers were Irish, I am, no pun intended, grandfathered in as an Irish team member because I couldn't make it on the American team because the American team is really good. And, you know, I'm an okay player. I'm not that good. So I squeezed my way into Team Ireland. I played last year and I'm going to play this year again. So looking forward to that.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's incredible. To get people all over the world.
Yeah. And these Europeans are so much fun. And each team has a personality somewhat like the country. Like the Italian team is kind of like what you would imagine a group of Italians would be like versus the German team and the British team and everything. It's a lot of fun. It's socializing around the games.
Clearly the Irish team already sounds like the most fun. No disrespect to the other countries.
But, I was told when I joined them not to worry about winning, but worry about how much beer we were drinking after the rounds every day.
And who's buying, I suppose.
The international aspect intrigues me because is there some like underlying subliminal tension that you're going against actual Germans who were the bad guys in these things or Italians?
It's a little bit of an aspect of it. So I tend to be reluctant to play the bad guys, and just in my own head, it just bothers me. And so, for example, my most common army is the British Army. That's the army I've always liked to play in Flames of War. But I have German units, and actually when I'm going to Ireland, I have to play the Germans because they have these rules about how many nationalities you have to have on your team that are represented in the game. And so I drew the short straw, and I'm playing the German army in that tournament. So, yeah, it is an interesting thing, but we're like, hey, we're playing a game. It's fancy chess. It doesn't mean we support anything that happened in World War II or whatever. So, you know, the typical,
Russ, are there categories of where, you're talking about you can fight different battles and things like that. Like, is there an 1812 group? Is there a 1776 group and another, I don't know how that's divided, but do you pick what category of battle you focus on?
Yeah. So usually in a tournament, you would pick a narrow window of time so that the armies that are facing each other are similar. So for example, in World War II, it's divided between early war, mid war, and late war. So early war is 39 to 41, and then it's 42 and 43, and then 44 and 45, because a 1939 army is gonna have no chance against a guy with King Tigers, right? But at least the other armies by late war have larger guns that can handle that and whatnot. So this tournament that we're playing in Europe happens to be a late war event. So all the armies will be representing whoever was still fighting in 1944 and 45.
Now, are they all? Is it a land battle? Is it all tanks, or do you have carrier groups and like air support? What is it like?
This particular game that we play is primarily land forces, tanks, infantry, armor. Guns, that kind of thing. You can have air support. It's pretty abstract, and there is certain lists occasionally can have naval gunfire support, but you don't see the ships on the board. That's sort of coming from really far away. So it's primarily a company-sized tank and infantry game.
Okay. And how far back? I was wondering, do the Punic Wars? I mean, how far back do some people do?
Oh, there are people that love, Napoleonics. There's all kinds of different games that are similar to this. This particular game company just spans from basically World War I to now, but there are a lot of different options of different kinds of games where you can play ancients, Napoleonics, Civil War, everything,
Wow.
anything that you like, there's a game out there for it. Any period of history you're interested in.
Now, Russ, you mentioned the what if thing, and that's always been fascinating to me. We've touched on the alternate history and things like that more than once on this show. But I'm sure the mechanics would support it if you wanted to. But do you ever find people doing the, okay, what if we're at the Battle of the Bulge and we have two M1s.
Yeah.
That we bring back from the future. What would happen? How does that play out? Are there people who do that and try that for fun, or is it just too imbalanced and weird?
No. Yeah, people have fun with that. The game has units that were on the drawing board but never built. And so you can buy them and build them and use them in the game if the tournament allows. So like they
Okay.
have the German Maus tank, that giant tank that was never actually put into operation. I think they had one prototype. So they have these experimental vehicles that you can use. So if you're a historical purist, you're like, oh, I don't want to add that. And so some tournaments will say yes, that's okay, and others will say no. I have this giant rat tank that I won in a tournament that basically has a battleship turret. That's how big the tank is.
Wow.
And the Germans had it on the drawing board. They never built
Yeah.
it, but they were thinking about it. And so I've long been thinking about how do I make a scenario where 100 tanks have to fight this thing because it's so big, that would probably be a fair fight, but I haven't quite done
it's Secrets of the Luftwaffe come to life on
Right, yeah, Secrets of the Wehrmacht, I
Exactly.
guess.
And like the last tournament I hosted, we did Operation Jupiter, which was a Winston Churchill brainstorm where he wanted to convince the Allies instead of going to North Africa, he wanted to invade Norway. And so that operation never happened, but there's a lot of information about what it would have looked like. So all of the Allied forces that landed in North Africa, they could have gone to Norway instead. And so actually played out a campaign of what that could have looked like.
Wow, that's
Wow.
cool. How did that turn out? Who won?
The Allies did poorly. The Germans, the Allies put a lot of resources in and did not make it very far into Norway. And their whole idea of sort of connecting with the Soviets and the Allies in northern Norway and Finland did not work out as it turned out.
Well,
That's
and
great.
Finland has such a complicated World War II history. It's almost impossible to sort of track, like, who was on what side and what was happening. It was changing sort of month to month. So that's really interesting that some of that uncertainty was maybe borne out in the game. Now, as you mentioned, that this what if thing I was on about, it depends on if the tournaments allow it. But like you and I sat down, and we could set up whatever we wanted, right? And the mechanics would support it. If you want to do that, here's this one tank, this battleship turret tank, and it's dropped into Iraq, and here's a bunch of M1s. Let's see what happens out of curiosity. That's
Yeah, because once you play the game enough and you understand the stats, you could probably figure out what the stats would be on something like that, right?
right.
How big is that gun? How thick is that armor? That kind of thing. So yeah, we would be able to sort of make it up to the best of our ability, play test it a few times until we thought it was working right, and then say, yeah, now let's go to a next gaming convention and say, okay, bring your army, challenge the super tank and see what happens.
Wow,
So
now I want to be Hydra. Oh,
yeah, I was gonna say
I
that.
mean,
You know, I was
yeah,
just gonna
right?
say we are essentially the Captain America movie is an alternative history. We had no Captain America, we had no Hydra, we had no bluey glowy weapons in our World War II. I'm curious whether it's ever come up that what somebody would say, let's just drop a super soldier in there, or let's drop some Hydra, blasty weapons in there and see what happened. That could be fun to develop the stats for something like that. What is one super soldier worth?
I think there's a game called Conflict 47, which is almost exactly that idea. It's like the war is still going on in 47, and technology has really taken a leap forward, almost science fiction-y. And so it really does have that Hydra feel, which I've never played it, but I've looked at it and thought about it. But yeah, I actually think you could scratch that itch as well, Brian, for sure.
Yeah, Brian would have portals opening up everywhere. And just...
Yeah,
totally. Now, when you were talking about the model work that is also involved in this. Now, are there like approved models with the company that they have? Like, here's your P-47 and here's your Sherman tank and here's the type of Stens you can use for the British.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting thing happening in the hobby right now, which is that, so this company is from New Zealand and they have the rules for the game and they sell models, right? So they, for a long time, were doing resin and metal models, which were kind of expensive. And then as they started to get undercut, they started switching to plastic. And not everybody loves plastic models, but they're cheaper. But of course, there's this little thing called 3D printing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and this is a real issue. So 3D printing is less expensive and all the diagrams are out there. And so it's a real fight for loyalty of the company. Or if you're playing their game, are you using their models? Some tournaments require that you use their models. Most don't, because it's actually kind of hard to tell. And so I would say my collection is probably 95% official and about 5% 3D printed that I've managed to, you know, sometimes you have to get something quick and you can't get it from them fast enough or in a big enough numbers. And so I'm like, okay, let me get 3D printed models of this tank, buy 10 of them. And they're also cheaper and faster. So hard to argue with that every once in a while.
Now I've got to fire up my 3D printer and make Gemini spacecraft with machine guns on them.
Exactly.
There you go.
I've got here's my little.
Jeep. Yeah, yeah. Oh, for our audio people listening in, we're all holding up our assorted toys.
Yeah, show and tell.
Russ has a great tank.
Russ is that's a beautiful tank.
A M10 Achilles, right? So British and German.
This is the only 3D printed thing I have handy. A coaster from the South Sea Club from the Rocketeer, thanks to my friend Hal.
Wow. Yeah. Well, if things get bad, I have my my Matchbox British Petroleum tow truck. Just, you know, we can pull the tanks off the field. I'm there for the cleanup. So
that's great.
It's amazing how universal this is. Everybody can understand the concept. I mean, you know, board games are common all over the world, but just being able to add and modify and make it your own is just a brilliant thing. And when would you say would be the heyday of it? Would this come from the 70s, or where did this all generate?
You know, like you guys were talking about earlier, so the board games of, you know, the Avalon Hill board games of what, the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, that was so huge. And Avalon Hill has kind of, you know, gone down from there. There's a lot more different companies making board games now. But this miniature gaming has been around for a long time, and it keeps sort of getting reinvented. Flames of War itself, I want to say 20, maybe a little bit more, so early 2000s. Was about the time I first noticed it, and I think it had already been out for a while. You know, there's science fiction versions, Warhammer 40K, that are very popular. In a lot of ways, the Flames of War, the historical one, is still kind of niche. So the kids love their big science fiction models, spaceships and hover tanks and things like that. And so it kind of takes a more nerdy military history group of people to want to play the World War II version. And we go to these big conventions and we'll be in the corner and there'll be 50 of us playing. And then the next room, Warhammer 40K, has literally 1,000 people playing. So that just gives you the relative levels of interest.
All these models that I'm assuming they're like 1/140th scale. I don't know what the scale that you typically use is, probably 144, I would think. But
just about that, yep.
When you're going to Milan and stuff like that, How do you pack this? And I'm just wondering what the TSA thinks when you're doing. I'm bringing this on carry-on. I've got 30 tanks and a couple of, you know.
They're not functional.
Yeah. I do have an over-the-shoulder carrying case, and I've brought that to one or two tournaments where you bring that as your carry-on luggage. And yeah, every time I've been stopped and I have to open it up and they look at it for a while and they go, what is this? And now I have this hard case that's smaller. It's all foam. And you can pull out the pieces of foam to exactly fit your model. And so it's a little, almost like a half briefcase size that fits. So I've already prepped it for the Milan trip. So it fits inside my regular luggage. And so it keeps all my models very safe for the trip. But yeah, so that is an issue. But
how many models would you take with you then to Milan? Are we talking a dozen, 100? What do you carry?
I think I've got about 60. So because I have I'm playing this Berlin infantry battle group, so it has a lot of not very well trained German infantry defending the city of Berlin, and a lot of like machine gun nests and hidden guns and things like that. And so yeah, it's a bigger army than I would normally carry, but I figured it out really well, and it's all going to be packed nicely.
So I'm picturing you must have a closet with a different shelf. Here's the Britain shelf. Here's the German shelf. Here's the Polish shelf. You know?
Yeah, sort of by country and timeline. And and do you carry structures as well? Like, do you have, for places to duck behind and stuff? Or
yeah, so the folks that are running the tournament are responsible for the terrain part. So each year they pick a different gaming club and they host it in a different part of Europe. And it's their job to assemble the 100 tables that they need with terrain for the event. And so some of the local European clubs that are near them will probably help them, but they don't, we're not required to come from America to bring the terrain. But when I host my tournament on the Hornet, I provide probably half the terrain and my various friends will bring the rest.
Yeah. I'm thinking that there's bridges that you have to blow, or railheads or beaches,
buildings and roads and forests. Yep. All that. So again, it's like HO scale. So if you're a train enthusiast, if you're using HO scale, hills and trees and stuff like that, that's basically what we use.
Okay, this is all a complicated lure to get me into this.
First he mentioned 3D printing, now he's talking trains.
Yeah, HO scale.
Seduced Jim.
I can feel this. Okay.
Come to California and join one of our events. I'll lend you an army. I have plenty to spare.
I have to say, no one's ever lent me an army before. Russ, you're tops in my book. Yeah.
There's something almost Shakespearean about that. Forsooth, Russell, lend me an army and I shall fight by your side.
Oh my goodness. Wow. I definitely will be checking this out. This is this sounds very dangerous to start. To get involved in.
I bet you could find a club in North Carolina.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there's probably a bunch out here.
Yeah. There's way more on the East Coast. In fact, there's a much higher density of players on that side of America than out here.
Yeah, I'm in Civil War country, so there's reenactors of every scale, even 1-to-1. So it's...
And, that's how they filmed the movie Gettysburg, right?
Exactly. Yeah, there's so many. One of our previous guests on the Rocketeer Minute, Billy Campbell, was one of his starting places in acting was he was a reenactor in Charlottesville. So, and apparently, worked on it, authenticity of his uniforms. But I think scaling it down sounds a little bit easier to do, and I'm not very good with a sewing machine, so that's
and somehow in the MCU I'm picturing Ant-Man with his pocket-sized tank that can then turn into the real thing, and that may be why TSA is giving you a second look, Russ.
I saw that movie, real tank.
Yes, where are your PIM particles coming up?
And just by coincidence, that full-size tank is about 1 mile from me right now at a museum.
There you go. Very cool.
Another reason to come visit.
Wow. Absolutely.
Well, Russ, I love that you have this in your life. I love that you do this. I love that it takes you all over the world, connects you with people of similar interests all over the place. It just sounds fantastic.
It's a lot of fun. It's educational. It scratches the itch of strategy games and hobbying and hanging out with your friends. It's so many good ways. Too many people sit at home by themselves playing video games. Nothing against that, and I do that sometimes too, but it's nice to get out and sit across the table from somebody and roll some dice.
Well, and you're the one guy in the group who gets to say, come on out and play with me. I have the keys to an aircraft carrier.
Exactly. Yes.
Now, one of us gets to say, one of us gets to say, my daughter has the keys to an aircraft carrier. Yeah. But the other two say, we know a guy who knows somebody who's got the keys.
Exactly. Wow.
Well, while we're in, this will be airing in June. What's going on at your neck of the woods at the Hornet Museum? Any good things happening in June of 2026?
We just had a really nice Memorial Day commemoration that just passed this last weekend. June is a little slow for the big events. We have two speaker series events. We like to talk about the Battle of Midway because our predecessor Hornet CV-8 was involved in that. And then we'll talk about the Battle of Philippine Sea, probably the most famous battle that our Hornet was involved in World War II. And so that's in early June and late June. But then July is a big month for us. So the 4th of July, 250th birthday of America. And then, of course, we celebrate the anniversary of the Apollo 11 splashdown every year on July 18th. And that's always one of my favorites. So we're going to have a really cool event this year.
I've got to put in a word because I had a little something to do with it. The Hornet is in the act right now of refreshing all of its space-related material. For listeners who may not know or didn't hear our last episode with Russ, the Hornet is the aircraft carrier that picked up Apollo 11 and Apollo 12 when they returned from the moon. And it has, in addition to all the, you know, warfare artifacts you'd expect an aircraft carrier to have, they have a really nice collection of space things. And they're just now in the process of spiffing it up, putting it in a new place out in the hangar bay where everybody can see it. And it's just going to be great, I think.
Yeah, and always remember, they're the ones that accomplished President Kennedy's goal of landing a man on the moon and, more importantly, returning him safely to the Earth. That was Hornet's job. Hornet got those three guys back to Earth. And, you know, it's an unforgettable experience and an important part of American and world history that the Hornet played in it.
And if I can give a quick return shout out, we've been consulting on this refresh of the space exhibit with our own friend Brian Fees here, who is quite the expert in this area. So, yes, that's been great.
It was fun to do. So I got to put in a plug for the Hornet because I love this place. And I just say to whenever listeners, if you're ever in the San Francisco Bay Area, you're interested in naval or space history, do not pass up a chance to visit the Hornet out on Alameda. You know, it's a little out of the way. I jokingly tell people to get to Alameda, which is an island, drive toward San Francisco till you hit water and turn left. And you can't miss it. It's the big boat.
Yeah, look for the big boat.
For the big boat. It's worth the effort. You can easily spend half a day. You could even spend a whole day touring this great historic aircraft that looks like the sailors just left it last week. And I'm gonna give the URL, USS-Hornet.org. Go there and see where Russ works. It's fantastic. I think I just did your job for you, Russ.
What? Thank you. That was perfect. Yes.
I did your plug.
Yes.
Wow. Well, Russ, thanks so much for being a part of this conversation. And also, we'd like to thank our audience for listening. And if you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base over on Facebook. And if you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like, you know, or whatever, hopefully a review at whatever podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests like Russ. So be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.